Hey everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the podcast where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I'm Patrick, and I'm back, as always, with my co-host Allison with an I.
Hey!
And Allison with a Y.
Hi!
And we are back for another full-length episode of Horror Catch-Up, where we are going to dig into all the horror things that we have been watching outside of our assignments for the podcast over the past month or so. And funnily enough, usually we talk about horror movies that aren't on Netflix for these catch-ups, but today we're going to start with a pretty big hit, actually, that very recently came to Netflix, and all three of us have seen it. M. Night Shyamalan's Trap, starring Josh Hartnett. And Allison with an I is, I think, the person who's seen it most recently. So why don't you lead us off, Allison with an I? Because I've already shared some of my thoughts on this in the past. But you tell us, what did you think of The Trap?
For starters, we've all seen this movie, correct?
Yes.
Correct.
Great. So I love me some Josh Hartnett.
Mm-hmm.
He was like the biggest heartthrob. Like, that man had everything I wanted and some more. He's got the bedroom eyes. He's tall, dark, handsome. Like, him in 40 Days and 40 Nights with Shannon Sossaman, I was just like, these are two of the most beautiful people on earth, making just all of my wildest dreams come true. So that said, that was a big draw for me. M. Night Shyamalan, we talked a lot about him a couple movies ago because we watched a movie that was his other daughter's directorial debut.
I forgot about that. Yeah, like, we were talking about the nepo baby factor, and I guess he is kind of nepo daddying his kids. I think that's pretty clear.
Nepo daddying the fuck out of his kids, because yeah. I didn't realize until very late into this movie that his other daughter, whose name is Salika Knight, plays the pop star in this movie. She plays the main, you know, second or third main character in this movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she's a musician in real life, too. Like, these are all her actual songs, if I remember correctly.
That is correct.
Yeah. I forget what her artist name is in real life, because I don't think she goes by her, like, full name. But, yeah.
Oh, she's Lady Raven in this.
In that, yeah.
In the movie, yeah. But in real life, she tours, I think, under some other musical name.
Beautiful girl. Truly very beautiful. Acting skills,
Yeah. It's like, maybe stick to being a pop star.
Although better than I expected. She surprised me. I mean, she's not Meryl Streep, but she was better. She was better than I expected.
It was rough for me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it wasn't great for me, but I kept comparing her to Skye Riley in Smile 2.
Yeah.
And first of all, I've talked on a separate horror catch-up. I think you and I, Patrick, talked about Smile 2. I loved that character, Skye Riley. I thought that actress was triple threat. She was fucking amazing. She did the choreo. She did the singing. She acted her ass off. I just adored that movie. So I couldn't help but compare the two. And this was an instance where these two pop characters were not friends. They were competing with each other in my mind. I've made that reference before in the past about how we shouldn't compare horror movies that are alike. I did that. I was guilty of that. This movie, you know, it's hard. There's not a lot of spoiler. There's a couple spoilers. And I think we decided we're not going to talk about those.
We can probably set those aside. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought this absolutely fucking sucked. I was angry the entire time watching it. I was like, I hate this movie.
I was sort of a little pleasantly surprised by it. It makes some really dumb decisions, including, at the very least, I'll just say, the whole movie doesn't take place at the concert, which is how it's marketed, that it's going to be like a horror thriller that takes place at a concert trying to catch a serial killer, and it does not follow through on that, and it starts to sputter as soon as they leave the concert, which is surprisingly, like, there's still a lot of the movie left when that happens.
Yeah, sooner than you wanted them to.
Yeah. And there's also just, I don't know, I think we, the three of us in particular, probably relate to this in a certain way because we go to a lot of concerts, and there's just some stuff about like the reality of going to a large concert like that does not make sense at all, where it's like, you're in an arena, like a large arena for this show, and Josh Hartnett's character leaves the concert so many fucking times and runs into the same people in the concourse of the arena so many times. It's like, no way. There's so fucking many people in here. No way.
You would not just run into your daughter by chance in one of the tunnels of an arena. Like, one of many things that pissed me off. I was also like, I pride myself on feeling like I can talk myself. I can sweet talk some door people into some privilege here. But that motherfucker, I was like, that would
charming never, motherfucker.
Never happen. The amount of luck this man had was unnerving.
Yes.
Josh Hartnett was the best part of that film.
Yes.
Like, he is, like, charming as hell. Where I remember feeling a little disturbed because for a while I'm like, am I kind of rooting for him?
Yeah,
totally. Like, it flips after a certain point, but I'm just like, I like him. He seems like a good dad.
I'm very here for the Hartnessance. Like, I love how he's kind of returned in the last 5 or so years and has shown up in some pretty impressive performances, actually. Yeah. And this is one of them. I loved how he portrayed a guy who is he's a sociopath. He's a fucking sicko. But also, when he's with his daughter, you're like, oh, he's such a good dad.
I know. I was like, could I look past the serial killer part? Because he is a really good dad. Like, yeah. That's how bad the dating scene is, by the way.
And the literal man of your dreams.
Yeah, and the literal man of my teenage dreams. Yeah. He carried the film. I didn't think his acting was very great in some ways. I'm kind of like, there's a reason he was out of the scene for a really long time. You know, he's not. Although a person that I watched the movie with reminded me that he was in, was it Black Hawk Down?
He was. Yeah. He was the main guy in that.
So he was doing a little more serious acting in that. This one, I just think I was so perturbed by the implied sheer incompetence of every other person in the movie.
Yes.
Down to the, like, police, which just further solidified that cops are the fucking weakest link always.
I was watching it. I'm like, everybody else is a fucking idiot. This guy is so fucking obvious right now.
Like, yeah. Well, and also just, like, again, concert logistics-wise, it's insane, the basic concept that the cops set up this entire second, like, daytime performance by what seems to be a Taylor Swift-caliber performer just to capture this one man, but then also somehow didn't track him coming into the concert hall. It's very far-fetched.
And, like, how many people they could have put in danger for this setup, where I'm this is, very unrealistic. It's trying to go for realism, and it doesn't live in the real world like that, though.
Yeah, to what demographic? Like, someone who's literally never been to a concert, or, like, someone who's...
Never watched a true crime documentary? Come on.
Exactly. And I kept being like, what mega pop star is going to want this PR attached to her tour?
She
not only signed on for this, but she was gung fucking ho about it. I'm right. Like, that is so that would never happen. Lady Gaga would never be like, you know what, let's catch this motherfucker at my concert with my vulnerable fans and put my name next to it. Like, what is happening?
It's a wild time.
So, yeah, that was my experience with Trap.
It's funny how these things, you know, sort of come back around based on what streaming platform they're on, you know, because, like, I feel like you have there was an initial wave of conversation I heard about this when it came out in theaters, then another wave when it hit, I think it was Max or something, was the streaming debut, and now, you know, Netflix is so universal that I feel like there's a whole third wave of dialogue that's coming up about this now. Just an interesting, I guess, side effect of the streaming era. But Allison with a Y and I watched another musically related horror film recently. Quite different from Trap, though.
Very
we watched
different.
The Phantom of the Paradise. Brian De Palma's very kooky rock opera adaptation of The Phantom of the Opera from 1974, and this was something that I was very excited for Allison with a Y to experience for the first time, because I had seen it before and I remembered it being nuts. So what was your first impression as a newbie to Phantom of the Paradise?
Oh, it was horror camp at maybe it's ideal horror camp for me. Yeah, it had that big, like, 70s camp queer energy happening, and it was glamorous and insane. I mean, this movie was... I didn't know what I was watching half the time, but I was enjoying it. I was there. I was having a good time. Mm-hmm. It's kind of all over the place. What a brain to come up with that film. And it was so weird because it clearly was trying to be like an adaptation of Phantom of the Opera and chose like very, very on the nose ways to be like an adaptation, and then veered off in just totally random ways and other ways that didn't like fully make sense. But I loved it. It also starred Jessica Harper, who was the lead in the original Suspiria as well.
Mm-hmm. Which I did not remember. That was total news to me. I was not aware of that the first time I watched this. And she can sing.
And she can sing very
decently.
Well.
Yeah. Yeah, it was weirder and more delightful than I remembered it, actually. And it's such an interesting outlier for De Palma, too. I mean, he's such a legendary director and such a talented visual visionary. But I don't know. I'm looking at his filmography right now, and I certainly haven't seen all his movies. Pretty sure it's the only musical he's ever done, and certainly the funniest thing he's ever done. Most of his other shit can veer towards campy or outrageous, but certainly not to the levels that this does. It has so much Rocky Horror energy.
Particularly, there's this amazing character in it named Beef. Just named Beef.
Yeah.
Who is very, very much felt like a mix of, it felt like a prototype of Frankenfurter and Rocky at the same time.
Yeah.
I have a confession.
What's your confession?
I've never seen Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh,
that's
shit.
That's incredible.
Wow.
I've missed some like real classic film in my life.
I feel like we need to fix this sometime.
Yeah.
If you're open to it.
Yeah.
I'm open. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
We should make that a group effort at some point.
That would be fun.
That would be super fun, yeah.
Yeah, I always enjoy watching that, so.
Yeah. I've seen it so many fucking times on stage, on screen.
Yeah, you were in it.
In my home, I was in it. I have maybe too much experience with Rocky Horror. But no, the last thing I want to shout out about Phantom of the Paradise, too, is the fucking king, Paul Williams, who stars in this. Amazing composer, amazing guy from everything I know about him. He did so much music for The Muppet Show and many of the Muppet movies, and just a legendary guy who you don't often see on screen to quite the degree that he's in Phantom of the Paradise. And that's another thing about this movie that just really delights me.
Yeah, I would have never, ever, ever guessed that man had anything to do with the Muppets after being in this film.
Yeah, he's not a very Muppet-friendly character.
What a wild trajectory.
Yeah. So yeah, if you like horror, if you like rock operas, and you haven't seen The Phantom of the Paradise, quit fucking
watch
around.
It. Yeah. Watch it. Get some friends together, especially, because it's like a good social film to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, moving along, Allison with an I, I know you have some new reading material to tell us about.
I do. I haven't read a book a week since the last time we talked because I've been very, very, very slow to read. I've been working on actually a lot of like activism stuff behind the scenes. So unlike the last time we did catch up where I said I was taking a break from politics and throwing myself into fictional literary horror, I've sort of pivoted and now I'm leading some activism measures and discussions. So that's been taking up some of my time. But I did read one novel since the last time we talked called The Devil in Silver, a 2012 novel written by a guy named Victor Laval. I don't know if you guys are familiar.
Yeah, I love this guy. Did you read the Ballad of Black Tom?
This was my first work by him.
Oh, okay,
so no.
Cool. Yeah. No, he's a really fascinating writer.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll monologue about him more in a minute, but tell us about the Devil in Silver.
Yeah, it was recommended to me by a fellow horror novel fan, and it was on my list for a really long time. It fell behind some of the others that I talked about a couple episodes ago in our last catch-up, but I finally got around to it, and I liked it. I thought it was decent. I'm just going to read the synopsis because it's better than I could paraphrase myself. Pepper is a surprised inmate of a mental institution in Queens, New York. In the darkness of his room on his first night, a terrifying creature with the body of an old man and the head of a bison nearly kills him before being hustled away by the hospital staff. It's no delusion. The other patients confirm that a devil roams the hallways when the sun goes down. Pepper rallies three other inmates in a plot to kill the monster that's stalking them, but can the devil die? The Devil in Silver is a thrillingly suspenseful literary work about friendship, love, and the courage to slay our own demons. So I like a psychiatric word horror situation. You know, it had some like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's vibes. It had some Girl Interrupted vibes. You know, not as Girl Interrupted is a masterpiece that I wouldn't put in the same category as anything else, but you know, it was in the same vein as that. So it deals with the horrors, whether real or imagined, right, of having mental illness or trying to get a mental illness diagnosis or being misdiagnosed with a mental illness, but all in all, just being living in a mental institution among other people who are dealing with their own stuff, you know? So there was definitely like some metaphors working there. It's hard to know at one point or another if things are real or imagined, like the book, like the synopsis implies. But I really liked the way he used that to kind of gaslight the reader into like, is this devil real? Is it not real? Is he an old man? Is he a mythological beast? And then the coming together of the patients in a way that reminded me of Girl Interrupted, where it was like, let's put our differences aside. Let's put our own struggles aside and like fight this common enemy. I liked it. You know, I really did. I rushed to finish it today so that I could talk about it. It wasn't a huge page turner for me. It wasn't the kind of book that I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait to go to bed tonight so that I can get back into this book. And I have to like peel myself away from it like 2 a.m. because I'm like, I got to go to bed. It wasn't that for me, but it was definitely like, I know we don't do ratings when it comes to ketchup, but I would say like keep it in your Libby queue. I don't know if it was a must read, but it was entertaining enough.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a really interesting figure to me. I've read probably his most acclaimed book, The Ballad of Black Tom, which came out in 2016. That won the Shirley Jackson Award for Best Novella that year. It was a finalist for the Stoker Award, Nebula. It was a big awards book, at least in the horror kind of genre community that year. And it's a really interesting one because Victor LaValle is Black, and he wrote this book, The Ballad of Black Tom, as a kind of rewrite or alternate take on an H.P. Lovecraft story called The Horror at Red Hook. And I think we're all at least somewhat familiar with H.P. Lovecraft's extreme racism that comes up quite regularly in his work. So it was a really interesting experiment for, you know, a Black author to recontextualize this story. So that was a very interesting book. And then I also read a collection of Richard Matheson's short stories few months ago that he edited, and that was like one of the draws for me, actually, because I knew that this guy had an interesting voice and interesting perspective from The Ballad of Black Tom, and I was like, okay, yeah, I want to see one of the most iconic horror short story writers of all time through this guy's perspective and kind of editorial lens. So he's an interesting character to me, for sure.
Yeah, I would definitely read more of his work. I'm going to check out that other book that you recommended because I do really like his voice. It's interesting what he does with race. I didn't realize he was a Black writer, which makes me respect him more now that I'm looking back at some of the like underpinnings of how he worked with race in this book, now having known that. So yeah, thanks for that shout out. That's good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess I'll move on to a couple of movies that I've checked out recently. I had the opportunity to enjoy The Monkey in the cinema in the last couple of weeks, and I fucking loved it. Oz Perkins, the writer-director, is, I don't know, he's been an interesting character to me for a while. We reviewed The Black Coat's Daughter on the show. I've also seen I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, which he did. And Long Legs, of course, was a gigantic success last year. And all three of those movies were really intriguing to me, but they just weren't quite there for me. And I think it felt like he was overreaching a little bit, like trying to do a little bit more than he was actually capable of theme-wise. But at the same time, I also saw like a director who has an incredible visual eye and works well with actors. And The Monkey, to me, is kind of the perfect vehicle for him. It's simpler. It's about a fucking wind-up monkey that happens to... just people happen to die around this monkey. It's based on a Stephen King short story that I've heard... I've not read, but I've heard is among the weirder things in King's lengthy bibliography. And I loved it. I mean, it's funny. It's gross as fuck. It's creative. And I was just entertained consistently for a nice short 90-ish minute runtime. I just had an absolute blast with that. Allison with a Y, I know you said absolutely not when we saw the trailer for that one.
Yep, absolutely not.
But you're not a gore person.
I'm not a gore person. Yeah. And also, funny story. So my best friend in high school, I used to go over to her house all the time. Her family had an antique wind-up monkey that looked exactly like the monkey, at least from what I can remember in the trailer. Uh-huh. And that thing scared the shit out of me every time I went over there. I did not like it. So okay. I was like, absolutely not.
So, thank you. So I won't bring one of those into the house then?
No. I don't forbid many things, but 'tis forbidden.
Yeah, it was just for me the perfect horror comedy. It's what I want out of a horror comedy, which is just black, dark humor and gross shit. I cackled multiple times throughout the movie and always at kills. There's just gross kills that are perfectly timed out for laughter. Very, very well done. My favorite thing that Oz Perkins has done so far by a long shot.
I wonder how much longer it's in theaters if I missed it already.
It might already be gone.
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah. I don't it's such a weird concept. I don't think it was going to have a super long shelf life, so you might have missed the window of opportunity, but I'm sure it'll be on Netflix or some shit in, 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's high on my priority list of things to watch. I'm sad I missed it.
Yeah, it's a good one. I also want to give a quick shout out to a movie that I was a big fucking hater about for a long time. Although I will say I think with good reason. And it's a movie that I think people might be like, huh, when I say it on Horror Ketchup. But Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, I revisited recently. I don't know what prompted me to, because I hated it when it came out, because it did my girl Wanda, the Scarlet Witch, dirty as hell after the amazing story arc that she got in the WandaVision TV series. And then it just throws all that shit out the fucking window. When I said it, all that aside this time around and just watched it as a Sam Raimi directed movie, it's Sam Raimi as fuck. It's delightful, Dutch angles out the ass, incredible visual style. It just has personality, unlike most Marvel movies, where you can really sense the director's tics and style. And especially the last half hour of it is horror as fuck. There's a zombie Doctor Strange walking around. He has a ghost cape that lifts him up. It's surprisingly gory. It's delightful. If you're not a superhero or Marvel person, but you like Sam Raimi, you like horror, check the shit out. It's much more Sam Raimi than that awful Oz movie that he made between Drag Me to Hell and Doctor Strange. So it's a good one. But we'll close out this episode of Horror Ketchup with a couple of podcast-related notes from Allison with a Y.
Yeah, for longtime listeners, I have come to the podcast with a lot of recommendations for horror podcasts or spooky podcasts, all things in that sort of vicinity. And so I was like, it's been a while since I found a new one. Let me try to find a new horror podcast to listen to. So I started listening to a fictionalized audio horror drama called Malevolent. And I'm only in the first season right now. It's five seasons, though, apparently. And
Malevolent. The word malevolent triggers me. We reviewed a very bad movie called Malevolent for the show a few months or years, I don't know, ago. But I'm sure the podcast is much better and has absolutely nothing to do with that. Just the word. I was like, huh.
Well, I like it because it's one of those ones that are very immersive, strong soundscape. And it starts out basically this guy wakes up and there is some kind of entity inside of him that has taken control of his sight and can basically talk to him in his mind. And this guy wakes up to, it takes place in the 1920s or 1930s. This man is a private eye, and he wakes up to find that his business partner is dead in their office. And he has this entity inside of him, basically like communicating to him, being like, I don't want to be in this either. So we're going to have to work together to figure out how this happened and untangle this mess that we are both in right now. And we need each other, basically. And it's very interesting. Like I said, it's very immersive. It's like a similar vibe to, if any of the listeners have listened to the Magnus Archives, that's a podcast that I've loved. It was so good. It kind of reminds me, similar vibe to that. I'm still fairly early on in it, but I think I'm going to continue listening to it. It's really good. I love a good audio horror drama. It's some of my favorite podcasts are that. So
nice.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. But that leads me to that we have added a new channel to our Discord to discuss horror podcasts. I love horror podcasts. I love all those spooky themed podcasts. And I'm sure there are plenty of listeners that love them as well. And so I think that would be a great opportunity for us to discuss some of them together. There are so many that I would love to discuss if anybody else there has listened to them. And I've been wanting to discuss them with the community a little bit more. So anybody can hop in and join that discussion. And also like share your favorite horror podcasts with us as well, because I'm always looking for new ones to listen to.
And you can find that on our Discord, the link to which is in the show notes for this episode. And I think that brings us to the close of another horror catch-up. Before we wrap things up today, we have a movie to pick. Whose turn is it to pick a movie?
It's your turn, Patrick.
Oh my gosh, what could I have picked?
Oh boy.
I don't know, I'm scared.
Oh god.
We are going to be watching next episode a movie called Mononoke, the movie, The Phantom in the Rain. And I looked at this at first and I thought, Princess Mononoke, like the Studio Ghibli Miyazaki film? No, completely unrelated. And the blurb for this says, in this chilling horror anime film, two young women enter a feudal harem and encounter a dark supernatural presence lurking in the shadows.
That sounds fascinating.
I am super pumped about anime. Ella and I have been watching an anime show together. It's our new show.
Nice.
So I bet I can rope her into watching this with me. And it's PG-13. She can handle it, but
great. Yeah.
Maybe it's mild salsa.
Yeah, I as longtime listeners know, I'm a big comic book nerd. I love my manga, I love my anime, and I don't know that we've ever had an anime selection on the film, let alone an animated. I can think of one animated movie that we've reviewed for the podcast before, but I think that might be it. So this is kind of an interesting boundary breaker. Animation style looked gorgeous and really, really unique to me. So this really
I'm excited for that.
I'm excited for this. Good pick, Patrick.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. I'm glad everybody's shaking stoked it up. On this. Yeah, shaking it up. Shaking it up. So that'll be next on Every Horror Movie on Netflix in 1 week from today, if you're listening on release day, that is. Until then, I'm Patrick.
I'm Allison with a Y.
I'm Allison with an I.
We'll see you next time.